You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to the wonderful community radio station 3CR, 8:55 a.m. on your dial, digital, and also online. This is also the Green Left Weekly breakfast show every Friday. And there's three of us here this morning. Myself, Mary Merkinich.
And me, Zane.
And me, Chloe. Morning, listeners. Good morning, Mary and Zane.
There's Harry.
Oh, and Harry, the dog.
The dog who's wandering between our legs. So if you hear any background noises, it could be Harry.
Yeah.
He's just been having some struggles chewing on a bone this morning. But, that's how you know it's live here at 3CR. Mm. There's a bit of dog hacking in the background sometimes. Now, of course, before we go too much further, it is Invasion Day coming up on Monday, and we'll be talking a bit about that. And I guess it would be good to start by recognising that we're meeting here at the 3CR studios in Collingwood on the lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people, the rightful sovereign owners of the land that was taken by brute force. Aboriginal people across this continent never ceded sovereignty, and their genocide and the colonisation of their land continues to this day, and so does the resistance. As socialists, we pledge to actively support First Nations people's struggle for justice, and this means recognising that we all have a part to play in decolonising and dismantling settler colonialism that fuels imperialism and all structures of oppression. Always was, always will be Aboriginal land.
And we have I'm just going to let you know who we're hoping to interview this morning at 7:30. We're hoping to interview one of the organisers of the Invasion Day rally here in Melbourne, Tarneen Onus Williams, who's a Yigar Gudjatmara Bindal Yoda Yoda woman, and have a discussion with her about First Nations rights in the lead up to Invasion Day. And also at 8:10 a.m. we'll be interviewing Green Left journalist and activist Peter Boyle about the large-scale attacks currently being carried out against Kurdish communities in Syria and the solidarity campaign for Rojava. But maybe we'll just go into some news headlines first. So there has been a bit of a victory in the protest movement, because we know the terrorist attack in Bondi has been followed by all these new laws aimed at blaming the movement for Palestine, and that includes our right to protest. But people have been resisting New South Wales Premier Minns' attack on the right to protest, and the Black Caucus won the right to march on Invasion Day, January 26th. So this is a great victory. The Black Caucus is calling for a big show of support, and they have vowed to march despite the undemocratic protest restrictions imposed by the New South Wales Labor government. Labor's anti-protest laws, which did pass, unfortunately, on December 24th with coalition support, gave this unelected bureaucrat the New South Wales Police Commissioner the power to decide which protests can go ahead for up to 3 months in 14-day increments. So that's why there was a lot of concern about the upcoming Invasion Day. So the Black Caucus and other civil rights groups credit their significant pushback against the restrictions on the freedom of speech and assembly for this decision. Basic human rights like the right to protest don't exist just on paper. They only exist when we actually use them and build a movement that can end the genocide and dismantle the whole system based on the carnage and the greed. So well done to all those who fought for the right to protest, particularly on Invasion Day.
Word. Yeah, and I think in the context of these new anti-hate laws that have been passed by the federal government, that's really important to defy bad laws which clamp down on freedom of speech and the right to protest. And that is the way to, that's the way to do it. And it has forever been thus. When there's bad laws, when there's an attempt to implement bad laws, the way to defeat them is to get out on the streets in big numbers and defy them. Or if they're bad union laws, to go on strike and defy anti-union laws. So yeah, bloody good to see, and we might need to do some more of that in the coming months and years.
Well, the people of Minnesota are certainly doing that too, aren't they?
Oh,
standing,
yeah.
Standing up to all those ICE agents, the thugs that Trump is calling patriots, who are murdering people and pulling people out of their homes, sometimes in their underwear, in below freezing temperatures, not giving them a chance to get dressed or anything. They're even arresting Indigenous Native Americans because they can't, because all they're doing is profiling people and assuming that someone who looks foreign is an illegal immigrant. So they've even been arresting Native Americans, the true owners, if you want to use that word, of the US. It's just despicable. But anyway, as you were saying, the positive side is that the people of Minnesota are standing up to them.
Yeah, there's lots of nationwide protests following an ICE killing, actually, in Minneapolis. Also, I just wanted to also draw attention to it's also in Gadigal country, Sydney, but a deaths in custody protest defied New South Wales laws. So this is just another example of protesters resisting these laws. And it was to mark 10 years since his uncle, Paul Silver's uncle, Donghori man, David Donge Jr. was murdered at Long Bay Jail. And so Paul Silver organised this protest at Hyde Park on December 16th, which also challenged the New South Wales new draconian anti-protest laws. And we've written about this in Green Left, so you can look it up, but a couple of hundred people attended to call for all end to all debts in custody and for justice and accountability for Donge Jr.'s murder. Very few First Nations debts in custody have made it to trial, so it is really important that we hit the streets whenever we lose a First Nations person. But yeah, there were so many cops at that rally. There was like 100 100 police, 12 mounted police were deployed to Hyde Park in a bid to intimidate those protesters and passerbyers. So, good on them for being able to continue with their march.
And isn't it noteworthy that, so in Sydney there's been a couple of protests in defiance of those new laws. There was a Snap Venezuela protest after the kidnapping of Nicolas Maduro and Celia Flores. And then there was, I think, another Palestine protest maybe a week or so ago. And I think there was a police presence there, but not this really super heavy-handed response. And it is when people are protesting against, you know, another Aboriginal death in custody, that that the police really come out and try and absolutely smash them. And like, how does smashing the kind of marginalised Aboriginal community who are standing up against deaths in custody, how does that combat anti-Semitism? This is police bullying of peaceful protesters and has got absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with anti-Semitism at all. It is just completely spurious, the link that they're trying to draw there.
Yeah, agree.
Yeah, it's pretty appalling.
Yeah. So can I bring up a different item? Mm. I was just going to bring up, there was a report released by scientists, climate scientists, and they are saying that it's absolutely clear that we are in a climate crisis right now. It's not on the way, it's here. And that we can expect severe climatic conditions, something like every four to five years instead of maybe, you know, once in a decade. But that figure, they hasten to add, is on average. So it doesn't mean that you have to patiently wait every 4 to 5 years for a horrible thing to happen. It might happen twice in 1 year, they said. And it's interesting that what we're experiencing at the moment is a heat wave, and it's the worst in 6 years. And this is during an El Niño event, which is supposed to bring wet and cool.
La Nina.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for correcting me.
The other one.
It's the one that they say is supposed to bring wet and cool weather.
Yeah.
And instead, we're having the worst heat wave in 6 years.
Yeah.
So, yeah. And meanwhile, our government is allowing new coal and mines to open.
Gas.
That's the one. Yeah. Yes.
Massive projects.
Yeah. Yeah.
Huge projects over in Western Australia.
Yeah. So, you know, it just shows their total disregard for climate science, but also for the community, because this is going to impact people, as we have already seen, and wildlife and our environment. It's a horrible, horrible scenario.
Mm. And there's big fires in Chile at the moment as well, in Patagonia. And who's that right-wing scumbag, Milei, the kind of libertarian president they've got? So I was reading an article that Cam Walker used to be a leading activist of Friends of the Earth for many years, and these days he's a volunteer with the Country Fire Authority. And so he's very interested both in climate change and also fighting fires. And he posted an article saying that since Milei, who's a climate skeptic, was elected the president of Chile, is he Chile or Argentina? Anyway, since he's got in, he's cut the firefighting budget by 70%. So they've got these huge fires. They're massively under-resourced.
I think Argentinian.
Yeah, okay.
Maybe?
Yeah, so I think there's big fires in Chile and Argentina at the moment. And, yeah, these huge cuts to the firefighting service there are a big problem. I imagine probably the firefighting service there was not as well resourced as what we've got here to begin with. To then cut that by 70% is a serious problem. And I think across the globe, we know that as these severe weather events become worse and worse, it's going to be the global south that is impacted hardest by these things. And to try and fight fires, this idea that we can just adapt to a planet that is 1.5 to 3 degrees hotter. We're at 1.5 degrees warming now, and we're having these severe heat waves once every 4 years on average instead of once every 25 years on average. If it's a 45 degree heat wave and you don't have access to an air conditioner, you're going to have a bad day. You could die. There's been a lot of work in this area about how, particularly in Australia, older people, older women who don't have much super balance, who tend to be at a higher risk of either homelessness or living rough or living in cheap, like poorly maintained, poorly insulated rentals, there's a real risk of death during severe heat waves because people are just getting cooked. They don't have access to air conditioning. And that's that sort of pattern will be repeated all across the global south. Severe weather will impact food production. Not everyone is in a wealthy country that's got a well-resourced fire department that can try and battle these mega fires that are a product of these heat waves. So,
but even our own fire departments, I think it was yesterday that the union leader, I've forgotten his name now, of the firefighters was pointing out how many trucks are really old and sometimes break down. So even our own firefighters are not well equipped.
And they're not paid a lot. Like the majority are, if I'm not mistaken, volunteer firefighters.
Yeah, and there's some young kids that are going out in the front lines. Meanwhile, we have these politicians that say they're climate skeptics, but I don't think they're climate skeptics. I think most of them are saying that because they want to sow confusion amongst ordinary Australians about the science, but they themselves really know what is going on. And they've probably got their own great fire avoidance or flood avoidance plans in place. They've probably got the best insurance, or if not, they can just afford to buy another $3 million house or whatever. So, they're just protecting the profits of big companies.
That's right. I'm skeptical that they're skeptical as well.
We need a new label for that. Like, this person is a conscious liar about climate change, a deliberate liar.
Yeah.
You just have to be pretty stupid at this point to not believe that climate is killing people and that it is, we're in the middle of a catastrophe. Anyway.
Yes. So, next time there's a people's blockade of the world's largest coal port, get up there. Next time you see climate mobilizations happening, get out on the streets because this thing ain't getting any less urgent.
Yeah.
We're going to go to a quick break. And we'll be back with more Green Left Radio.
Monday, the 26th of January, marks Invasion Day, and 3CR's First Nations broadcast team will be bringing an annual Invasion Day broadcast to the airwaves from 10 a.m.
In 1788, down Sydney Cove, first boat people land, and they say, "Sorry, boys, I gained your loss. We're gonna steal your land."
Our team will be broadcasting speeches from the NAM rally and conversations with people attending the march, as well as connecting with Aboriginal activists from across the continent at the forefront of campaigns for land rights, restoration, restitution and real treaties, and learning about the way it may be done. And of course, we'll be playing deadly music from our incredible black artists, past and present. So keep it tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m, 3CR Digital, 3cr.org.au streaming live on Monday the 26th of January from 10 a.m.
You're back listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR. We thought we'd go to a song before giving you more news headlines because we've been talking a lot. And what are we going to play?
Yeah, a song's always good. We're going to play Black Matriarchy by Barker. It's great.
I'm tired of begging and asking for our humanity. When is it enough?
Hand colonized. recognize my black mind. I'm from a dream time, I go back. They commit a genocide through my tracks. They raped our mothers less than my black. They bought the violence when they attacked. I ain't here to start trouble, I'm just here to state facts. You can't paint me how you wanna paint cracks. And I'm tied to my mob, got my mob on my back. Waratahs are covered in blood, whitewashing our history to cover it up. Proof is all in the pudding, cause this nation couldn't give a fuck about us. We survive unseated, undivided. Our people stay fighting cause the flame is ignited. We stay righteous, we cannot be silenced, cause silence is violence, the reason we're divided. And they choose not to digest the truth, instead they just go ahead and delude our youth. Only love the system cause it just suits you. Give a fuck about the law, yeah, I'd rather grassroots. Black to the bone, black to the busy. Mob on my back, yeah, they all rock with me. Barker in my blood, that river flow through me. I'm matriarchal bloodline, 120. Black. This for the black matriarchs. This for my sisters who lived in the dark. This for my sisters who carry our past on their shoulders. This is for black matriarchs. This is for all of our women. This is for all of our children. Couldn't care less about the monarch. I'ma set fire to the kingdom, I'm coming for them. More hail to black matriarchs. I'm the pain and the proof, the history that lays out the truth. And they couldn't walk a mile in our shoes. Tell us to go bush when they all introduce. Fuck it, we've been here for too long. Matriarchy blood, yeah, I've been built strong. Songlines deep, yeah, got me singing songs. Cause I can't forget where I came from. Barkindji country, Mungo man. Pass it to my kids, tell them this your land. I came from the dirt, go back in red sand. There's a river, Nunku, I'm proud of who I am. Creator created me tough. And I'm calling out all your bluffs. Saying the past is all in the past. Well, that dark past still lives in my mum. I stay radical, I know the truth. Couldn't kill my ancestors, I'm the proof. I know I still got some screws loose. But my third eye's open and I'm looking right through. Looking at you, Nunku right here. Gonna do what I do. So my little black seeds ain't gonna prove shit to you. 90% me gone, bud, what do? 3% me, hold it down for the few. This for the black matriarchs. This for my sisters who lived in the dark. This for my sisters who carry our past on their shoulders. This is for black matriarchs. This is for all of our women. This is for all of our children. Couldn't care less about the monarch. I'ma set fire to the kingdom, I'm coming for them. More hail to black matriarchs.
You know, I have a culture. I am a cultured person. Don't try and suppress me. And don't call me a problem. I have never left my country. I am not the problem.
You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, your Friday breakfast team here. And that was Black Matriarchy by Barker, you were listening to just now. So we're going to go to some more news just before we have our first interview of the show. And I thought we'd bring you a little bit of news from Palestine. Israel is raising a strategic area of Rafah now in southern Gaza, which is compacting the ground and clearing rubble in a way that suggests that the land is actually being prepared for the construction of new residential infrastructure. That's according to new research by Forensic Architecture. So these findings are based on an analysis of satellite imagery, and it suggests that Israel is now starting to build infrastructure which may be used to house maybe Palestinians and effectively contain them in an area under full Israeli military control. So we want to reject Trump's neocolonial plan for Gaza, and we also need to keep demanding the Australian government breaks its military alliance with the US, and the United States is the main reason Israel has been able to continue its genocide in Gaza for over 2 years now. Also, 4 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza as Trump launches a board of peace. And medical sources at the Al-Shifa hospital say at least 4 people have been killed by Israeli fire in Gaza, and that includes an infant who died from a cold. And since this so-called ceasefire was called, 394 Palestinians have been killed, 1,000 and 75 have been injured and 634 bodies have been retrieved from under the rubble, according to the Ministry of Health, which I'm guessing is underestimating maybe those figures. And this Board of Peace has really been set up to oversee the construction of reconstruction of Gaza, and it was always going to be problematic given US complicity in Israel's genocide campaign in the Strip. The board comprises of billionaires and pro-Israel figures, with a Bulgarian diplomat being named its highest representative. So yeah, you can read more about this in Green Left. There's an article by sorry, I've forgotten the author's name actually, but yeah, there is. We have covered what this Board of Peace actually means.
Don't you just love the fact that Trump is also asking for those who join to pay him? How many million is it?
It's
a billion.
A billion.
Yeah. Well, about a billion US, so it's like 1.5 billion Australian.
So he's making money out of it as well as making sure that it's controlled by him and his buddies.
That's right.
Yeah, and the concern is that he's basically setting up an alternative body that will sideline the UN, and which this it's initially concerning itself with rebuilding Gaza, no doubt in a sort of a pro-settler imperialist manner, but the concern from some commentators has been that this thing is an attempt to set up kind of like an alternative body to the UN, to bypass the UN.
Oh, really? I hadn't heard that.
Mm.
Okay. Oh. Gets worse by the second.
Yeah.
Binoy Camp Mark was the writer I was talking about. A really fantastic writer for Green Left. Okay, in other news, in Venezuela, the US has seized another Venezuelan oil tanker in the Caribbean. This is the seventh vessel to be captured by the Trump administration as part of the a months-long military campaign to control Venezuela's oil reserves and more. And Donald Trump has also signaled he's open to involving right-wing Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado in some political capacity in Venezuela following the violent U.S. military intervention into Venezuela that led to the abduction of President Nicolas Maduro and his partner Celia Flores. Machado and Trump met at the White House last week, where Machado said she gave her Nobel Peace Prize to Trump.
And Trump's been getting insulted across social media because just the idea of accepting this Nobel Peace Prize from Machado is, it's kind of like a participation trophy, like, oh, you didn't win, but here you go, you can have it anyway. Good on you, there you go.
Please let me lead Venezuela.
Yeah.
But it's not going to happen by the looks of it. He sidelined her.
Hmm.
And just the last bit of news, we are going to be interviewing Peter Boyle about this later in the show, but the Kurdish city of Kobani is now besieged by jihadists and cut off from water, electricity and basic necessities. The internet has also been shut down. Kobani and the Kurdish people are at risk of genocide. We will be discussing a little bit more behind around the politics of what's going on over there. All right, well, we're going to go to a quick break and hopefully be back with our first interview.
The state government has sold 578 hectares of public land to private developers. They're building private public partnership model housing over public housing land, and it's just not on.
Housing is just massively expensive. It's never been effective in this country to rely on the market to provide decent housing for people.
Rent has risen by 21%. That's median rent across the country as of January this year.
As the rents keep rising, so must we. And we must stand together as a collective, because this war cannot be won by the few. It will only be victorious by the many.
3CR. Stay tuned. Stay radical.
The organisation I work with, 3CR Community Radio, has been our partner for the last 45 years. They've always been a part of our struggle, particularly on Invasion Day. And today they're doing a whole day of broadcasting and programming around Invasion Day, as they usually do. For the last couple of decades, they've done that for us. I just want to acknowledge the 3CR mob.
You're back listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR, and you were just listening to a track called Treaty by Yothu Yindi. But we were able to get Peter Boyle, who is a Green Left journalist and socialist activist and a member of Socialist Alliance, on the show. Welcome, Peter.
Good morning.
Now, Peter, we've got you on the program today to hopefully give us a little bit of an update on what is happening in Rojava. So to start off, can you give us a little bit of an update on what's happening on the ground in Rojava, including the Kurdish city of Kobani?
Yes, it's a very dire situation because since earlier this year, since the beginning of January, there has been basically what appears to be a planned military assault by the current Syrian transitional government led by Ahmad al-Shara. And this is basically a government that over the last year has been strongly supported by the Western imperial powers. And it's led by a self-appointed president who was a former commander of al-Qaeda. So this is a government based on very reactionary forces that has been basically rehabilitated politically for the world by the West, because it has now been chosen as its main ally in the region. Now, the story is becoming clearer. On January the 4th, there was a secret meeting between several big powers, including the United States, France, Israel, and this new Syrian regime in Paris. And at this meeting, basically, they seem to have come to an agreement that the big imperialist powers would stop supporting the the Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces, which had liberated for some time roughly a third of Syrian territory in the direction of the northeast. At the time, there was an agreement that had been reached earlier the previous year, in March 10th of last year, between the Rojava administration and particularly the SDF, or Syrian Democratic Forces, and the new regime, to try and negotiate a peaceful process to integrate into unified Syria, one in which there would be considerable autonomy for the areas that were part of Rojava. But that agreement was never implemented. It was stalling all along. And therefore, it now becomes clear there's a second track secret discussion going on with the US and its imperial allies with the new regime. And this came to a head at the beginning of this year. So everything starts to roll very fast from that. First of all, an attack on predominantly Kurdish and Yazidi neighborhoods in Aleppo, which is the second largest city in Syria. This is a part which is overall not in the SDF's control, but they have had autonomous neighborhoods which were armed and were protected by the SDF. So first of all, attacks start against these neighborhoods in Aleppo. And instead of being allowed to defend themselves, which they could have, the United States envoy, Tom Barrack, in the region, who's a very shady character, under the previous Trump administration, actually, he was facing charges of being a so-called agent of foreign influence, because he's been taking money from a lot of the regional powers, from a lot of the Arab states around the country, as part of his business interests. Anyway, this guy, Tom Barrack, intervenes in a discussion and says to the Kurds, remove your armed forces from the neighborhoods in Aleppo. We'll peacefully escort you out, and we will ensure that the neighborhoods will be safe. And nobody really totally believes that, but under huge pressure, the SDF removes its main forces. However, the local self-policing security force decide to stay with their neighborhoods and their people, and they are promptly attacked by the new Syrian regime and by various militias, jihadist militias who are working with them. And there's this horrible rampage through those neighborhoods. People are killed. Bodies are desecrated. Fleeing residents are separated between men and women. Some of the men and young boys are put in buses and taken away and never to be heard from again. I've spoken to some family members who live in Australia who have lost their family members in this process. The following next few days, the same thing happens to another piece of territory not far away, just slightly north of Aleppo, and that is a territory that has been controlled by the SDF, or the Kurds, Kurdish-led forces, since the collapse of the Assad regime. And this was an attempt to make a kind of a bridge between Rojava and these neighborhoods in Aleppo. Same thing basically happens. The United States intervenes, says, no, you've got to withdraw. This will be a protective withdrawal. The SDF, again under pressure, withdraws from these areas. Even before the withdrawal is complete, they are attacked and they lose a lot of people. And basically this has been going on all along, ever since then. They're being forced to withdraw fundamentally because the United States and the European Union have switched sides completely and abandoned the Kurds and the Rojava revolution. This was becoming clear for people who were watching. But then finally, as this process goes on and the Kurds are pushed further and further north, on January 21st, Tom Barrack, who's this U.S. special envoy, puts out a very, very blunt statement on X, where he says, historically, the Kurds were a useful partner in the fight against Islamic State, or ISIS. But now, the situation has fundamentally changed. The government is now supporting the al-Shara Syrian transitional government. It's going to be our primary partnership. And the Kurds basically have to surrender their armed forces. Individual members might be accepted into the Syrian armed forces after they have been politically vetted. All control of those areas that were liberated by the Kurds in Rojava have to be handed over. So the U.S. made it very clear, it's abandoned. It's abandoned this alliance, which has been going on for some time, with the Kurds, with Europe, basically to fight ISIS. So everything has changed now in the last few days. The attack has rolled on, despite officially there being a four-day ceasefire. And Rojava now is reduced to two small areas. One is an area around Kobani, which was the scene of a historic and a battle, and extremely heroic battle between 2014 and 2015, where it was besieged by a series of jihadist militia, including ISIS, and was eventually, after this historic siege, which is being compared to the siege of Stalingrad, after thousands of lives were lost, basically they freed themselves, and that began the turning of the tide against ISIS and started an offensive, which the Kurds led, which eventually led to the collapse of the so-called ISIS or Islamic Caliphate in 2019. So right now, the Rojava is reduced to an area around Kobani. It's completely surrounded. To its north is Turkey, which has built a fortified fence. It's got its tanks there. They've been cut off from water, electricity, and the internet. They have some intermittent internet connection through Turkish internet services that goes off and on. So they're basically, like 350,000 people are trapped in that area, and they are having to fight for their lives. A bit further to the north is a bigger area around the de facto capital of Rojava, Temeswar, and it is, being currently, it's there's not active fighting, but there's tension all along the edges, and it's expected that that fighting will break out as soon as in the next couple of days. essentially what's happened is the SDF has been forced to retreat to the predominantly Kurdish areas. Now, the SDF was actually not just the Kurds. It was an alliance with various Arab tribes in the area who over the last few years had worked peacefully together with the Kurds in Rojava, trying to implement this, a grassroots democracy, which included all the different nationalities and religions. But what it appears is the leadership of many of this Arab sections of the SDF, as soon as it became clear that the Syrian transitional government was on a full military assault and that the US and Europe were going to support them, they began switching sides. So this partly accounts for the speed of the retreat of the SDF. So that's where we are up today. It's down for a fight for survival for Rojava, which it's a very, very sad time, because Rojava was probably, well, it was the only surviving, I think, revolutionary, truly revolutionary and liberationist impulse from the, what you could broadly call the Arab Spring protests. Mm. And in fact, if you want to think of it, it's actually the only revolutionary liberationist project that we are seeing since the Chavista revolution in Venezuela, way back, at the beginning of this century. It's the only possibly surviving 21st century revolution, and it's now being besieged by an awful alliance of Islamic fundamentalists, almost al-Qaeda type forces, and the imperialist countries.
It's pretty harrowing to see the reports coming out of there, Peter. As someone who's, witnessed the whole war on terror that followed the September 11 attacks, can you just comment on the just profound hypocrisy and the profound moral bankruptcy of the US after spending 25 years talking about saving the world from, Islamic extremists and blah, 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 as soon as the geopolitics and the international, imperialists chessboard says it's a good idea, they'll just throw the Kurds under the bus. And all of this rhetoric about defending women and defending civil rights and blah, blah, blah is just shown to be complete mealy-mouthed bullshit.
It is pretty astounding, isn't it? But when you think of it, all that pretense has been pretty much blown out of the water by the Trump administration, and certainly that in its second round, right? Trump has basically made it very clear he doesn't believe all that shit.
Mm.
It's all about power, and it's about asserting U.S. imperial power. I think the real embarrassment now, if you like, is for the governments of Western Europe and Australia, all these people who are still sticking by as solid, in the end, solid military allies of the United States, despite the pretense being totally dropped by Trump. What are they saying, And this is where the silence from our Prime Minister, Anthony Albanese, is deafening. They're saying nothing. They're squirming a bit in Western Europe. Macron's making a few statements. German government is terribly silent. I think the British government, Starmer government, is squirming a little bit. Of course, it's all blown out of the water. That old saying some ancient Tory made, I think in the 18th century or 19th century, about the British imperial power having no friends, only interests. Well, now we know that applies absolutely with today's imperial powers.
And is there a path, a people-powered path, to stop this genocide? Like we've seen around the world, the huge protests in solidarity with Gaza over the last couple of years, and you're old enough to remember, and I'm old enough to remember when Palestine solidarity protests were more of a, you know, fringe thing from socialists who understood the politics of what was happening there and understood the importance of standing with the people of Palestine. But it snowballed and it took off because people gained an understanding that the people of Palestine were, you know, facing a genocide, facing extermination. Is there potential to build something like that in support of the Kurdish population of Rojava?
There is a potential for something like this to build up international solidarity campaign, because there was a huge campaign that built up between 2014, 2015 around the siege of Kobani. It became, you know, the female Kurdish fighter became almost, you know, the modern symbol of standing up against empire, and people from all around the world flocked there. There were internationalists who went over to fight to help defend Kobani, gave their lives. There was a huge movement of solidarity. Wherever things have roll back in this regard, you know, over the years, because people got complacent. The politics within part of the progressive movement started to go a bit dodgy. One section of the left wanting to defend the Assad dictatorship, another section of the left being throwing its weight behind the so-called Free Syria Army, you know, the remnants of the opposition to Assad during the Syrian civil war, opposition that became increasingly captured by other regional powers like Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and in its political complexion became more conservative and Islamist in its politics. Nevertheless, there was one section of, like, the left progressive movement said, oh, these are the true voices of the Syrian people. So that the left was divided on this politically. I would have to say that in this country, the Socialist Alliance is one of the few countries that has basically kept its support for Rojava right through this process. You know, we've been speaking out, being active in building solidarity. Now, in the region, there is, of course, already a massive movement to defend Rojava. Thousands of people have gathered from Turkey, mostly Kurds, of course, on the border. They are currently fighting with the Turkish army. There's video coming out. There is fighting going on. They want to cross over the border to help defend Kobani. From the further northeast, from Iraq, which is that part of Iraq is the so-called Kurdistan regional government of Iraq. It's an autonomous area, mainly populated by Kurds. From there, again, thousands have come to the border. Now, that border is open because it's controlled by Rojava, and, you know, supplies are coming in. Supplies are coming in. Volunteers are coming in. Some armed forces from the Iraqi Kurdistan have come in, so we're not so much worried about that, because that there's an actual, if you like, a line from the outside world, and international support is coming that way. The biggest challenge is going to be Kobani, because basically, having learned the lesson of what happened in the siege of Kobani, the Turkish state has built this huge wall. It's a bit like the walls that Israel has built to divide the West Bank. And you know, it's got its armed forces there. But nevertheless, people are massing. Now, this impacts quite And maybe this might be offer some possibility of pushing back the powerful outside forces, including the imperialist countries and Turkey, from supporting a full-on war of extermination of Rojava. And I say this is because of the potential of things exploding in Turkey. Well, they are now. There's been a so-called, you know, a Kurdish-initiated peace process, but I'd say this is pretty much dead now. And there's a very large section of Turkish population is Kurdish and pro-Kurdish, and they are spoiling for a fight. So if you like, the revolution may explode, the Kurdish-led revolution may now explode in Turkey, and that might make the imperialists feel, oh, you know, perhaps we better broker some sort of settlement here.
Or could it mean that the US will send troops there, maybe even surreptitiously to support the Turkish and the Syrian leaders?
Well, they have troops there already, not a lot, you know, but they have troops in the country and they have airfields. And, of course, Turkey is NATO ally and they have huge military bases there. Yes, I mean, the US certainly has the capacity to intervene dramatically to finish off the what's left of Rojava. There's no doubt. We've seen what the U.S. military can still do, you know, as we just saw as recently in Venezuela. But it's political in the end, isn't it? You know, This is going to be decided politically rather than purely as to whether they have the military capacity, because we know they have. You know, I mean, the shape, if anybody had any illusions about what the shape of the world is, you know, the preponderance, the domination of the United States, despite its weakening economy, you know, it is still the imperial hegemon. It has the biggest military force of any country in the world. It has the capacity to intervene everywhere. You know, it's got military bases everywhere. And so we know that. That's not the good news, that's the bad news. If anything, you know, what Trump has done is just help the world see things for what they are.
Mm.
But in the end, it is political.
Yeah.
You know, what can they afford to lose?
And if there were mobilizations within the US, perhaps as well, I'm sure there are some now, but and I wonder how ordinary soldiers in the US military must be feeling at the moment about all of the things that they're being asked to do when they're seeing their own country, as in Minnesota, being almost like a civil war in Minnesota. I just wonder if, and I don't know if you can answer this, Peter, but if there would be any kind of unrest within the US Army amongst ordinary soldiers.
I think it's possible. There is a video clip that's going viral right now of a U.S. A female U.S. soldier stationed in Syria, and she's making this. She's speaking to camera in tears, you know, about what she sees as a betrayal. Now, you know, we've got to check all these things, and there's so much. There's so much video going around which might or might not be true, but it's definitely gone viral. It's gone viral together with another video which is absolutely horrible, and it's one of the Syrian militia groups holding up the braid of hair from a woman, a Kurdish fighter, who allegedly he has raped and killed, and he's sort of waving it as a trophy, and that's gone absolutely viral.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of stuff going around like that. I mean, you have to imagine that some members of the in the U.S. Armed Forces are feeling really bad, not just about what's happening overseas, you know, in Syria and and the threats to Greenland, but also at home, as you said in Minnesota, you have to think that there are people thinking, you know, well, I don't know whether what stage this is at. You know, are people just feeling doing, or is there, you know, the beginnings of a rumbling of a resistance within the armed forces, like we saw during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
It was powerful. It was very powerful. Soldiers didn't want to fight. Some soldiers even turned their weapons against their officers at one point. It was a huge movement. It was a huge movement that was part of the anti-Vietnam War movement.
Well, Peter, this has been a really great interview, but we are coming to the end. And I just wanted to... Well, we want to keep showing our solidarity, particularly with the Kurds who are mobilising against the impending genocide, including the Kurdish Women's Protection Unit fighters in northern East Syria, resisting the Turkish-backed Syrian government forces. But
there are protests happening, you know, literally every few days now in all the major cities in Australia, in Sydney, Melbourne, Adelaide, Perth, and we had one in Canberra a couple of days ago. And, you know, so there's an opportunity for people to come and support them. You know, the numbers of non-Kurdish people at this protest, they're too few. The word needs to get out. People need to show solidarity. They need to declare declare their humanity, because that's really what's at stake here. You know, they need to come and put their bodies there and stand side by side with these Kurdish communities who feel completely abandoned at this moment, you know, completely abandoned.
Yeah, absolutely. And, just lastly, the Rojava revolution, it does represent a threat to Western imperialism and all the reactionary regimes in the region. I was reading a quote from journalist Behrouz Bichani, who once said that, well, he once called Rojava the most progressive and democratic system in the history of the Middle East. So you did mention the rallies across the country, Peter, but I guess just to wrap up the interview, why is it important that all socialists actively support Rojava in its hour of existential need?
Yeah, because Rojava does stand more for something more than just a territory. It stands for a different vision of how society can be run. It's fundamentally based on a very powerful thing. We've never seen a revolution so much based on the empowerment and the liberation of women. And that's been iconic for this revolution. And it's, like, if you like, doubly iconic, because it's taking place in a region where, if anything, the trend has been the opposite direction. Women have been forced to wear the veil, been turned back into hide in their homes, you know, to be sold as chattel. And this is a revolution that puts that up front. Every single position has to be led by, you know, shared with a co-chair, with a woman, etc. So there's been this huge empowerment of women. Secondly, it is based on a cooperative system. It's, if you like, an indigenous cooperative system, but there's a whole series of cooperatives that actually run large sections of the economy in Rojava. And finally, it's not been easy for them to implement this. They have at least a formal political commitment and constitutional commitment to respect for the environment. So you got these three elements together with a vision of grassroots democracy that is, if you like, they call it confederalism. It organizes right from the lowest layer, and it is inclusive of all different communities, despite whatever their religions, ethnicity, etc. So this was an experiment that has been going on there. We need to defend it, because in the end, you know, like, it's not just Syria. It's every country in the region has this challenge, has a challenge of empowerment of women. It's a challenge to even achieve the most basic elements of gender equality, but also has societies which are multi-ethnic and multi-religious in character. And the imperialists have been exploiting this by turning one community against the other, and that's how they've maintained their rule from way back in the times when the British and the French carved up the area before the US came along. That's the game they were playing, pitting one section of society against another. So in that sense, it's profoundly subversive of the main form of imperial power maintaining itself. You know, this confederalism, this attempt to unify all these groups, you know, and to empower women, this makes this project one very subversive of imperial power.
Yeah, thank you for joining us on the program, Peter, and for all your work in the Kurdish Solidarity Campaign. And
yeah, cheers, Peter.
Yeah.
Cheers.
Bye, Peter.
See ya.
And we encourage everyone to stand with the Kurdish people right now and demand that to stop the war against the Kurds and stand for peace, justice and freedom. Stay with us. We're going to just go to a short break.
The revolution in Rojava is a beacon of hope for the world, putting direct democracy and feminism into practice on a broad scale. This radical attempt at social transformation now faces huge challenges, including daily attacks by the Turkish military with little outside recognition or aid. Show your support for Rojava by joining Northeast Syria Solidarity, or NESS, and help ensure the survival of this inspiring experiment in social change. NESS sends aid, raises awareness, and builds solidarity. Get involved at www.nesssolidarity.org.au. NESS is a 3CR supporter.
We're back live, coming to you from 3CR studio. This is Green Left Radio, your Friday breakfast team. And we were just interviewing Peter Boyle, who's a Green Left journalist and veteran socialist activist and a member of the Socialist Alliance. He was giving us an update on what's happening in Rojava. And yeah, we're podcasting all of these interviews, so if you did miss it, we'll put it up on the show notes. We are going to read the activist calendar now. What's today? Friday. I'm not sure what's happening today, but Saturday, January 24th, there's going to be a banner painting for the Invasion Day rally in Bunurong country at 10:30 a.m. Narre Warren Mechanics Hall, and that's 59 Webb Street, Narre Warren. Sunday, January the 25th, there's going to be a smoking ceremony, 2:30 p.m. at Camp Sovereignty, Lynn Lithgow Avenue in Nam, Melbourne. And then we've got the Invasion Day rally on Monday, January the 26th. And that's starting at Parliament House of Victoria. I'm going to get there really early because I'm anticipating a massive crowd. The crowds actually seem to be increasing every year, which is great. But I think the rally starts at...
I think it's 11?
11 a.m. Yeah.
And if there's any fellow CFMEU members out there listening... there is going to be a CFMAU block marching to meet the Invasion Day rally. Meet at the CFMAU office at 9 a.m. on Elizabeth Street on Monday morning. And yeah, the Construction Union does have a proud history of working in collaboration with struggles for land rights and Aboriginal justice. And one of the many shitty things that administration has done is go after a bunch of our staunch Koori activists in the Koori Construction Group in the CFMAU. So, yeah, if you are a CFMAU member, please show up, show your support, and, yeah, stand up and be counted, and we'll march together and go and join the main rally.
Thursday, Thursday, January the 29th, there's going to be a forum, Trump's War on Latin America, 6:30 at the MUA, the Maritime Union of Australia, which is 46 to 54 Island Street in West Melbourne. It's a walking distance from North Melbourne train station. And we did interview one of the panelists on last week's show, Federico Fuentes, who's the editor of Link's International Journal of Socialist Renewal. And we're flying, so Fred's going to be flying in, as well as we've also got Carlos Eduardo Moreo, who's a writer, editor, and organizer living here in Nam. So both these, it's going to be a really great forum because both these speakers actually lived and worked in Venezuela. Fred worked from Caracas during the first decade of the Bolivarian Revolution under Hugo Chavez. So, and yeah, Carlos was a lecturer in Venezuela as well. So it will be interesting to hear from those two speakers. So please make sure you get down to it. Sunday, February the 1st, there'll be a fundraiser, Fun Run for Gaza, Sudan and First Nations. That's going to be at 9 a.m. at Footscray Park in Maribyrnong, River Trail in Footscray. Northern Suburbs for Palestine, 2026 Strategy Day is going to be at 12:30 until 5 p.m. at the Schoolhouse Studios, 28 Victoria Street, Coburg. Then there's going to be another smoking ceremony at Camp Sovereignty, 2:30 p.m. Did you have any like events that you wanted to add, Mary or Zane, or do you want to just keep reading?
I don't have any at the moment.
All right, I'll quickly finish the calendar then. There's going to be a fight for our right to protest at 5:30 p.m. at Parliament, Spring Street. That's going to be Tuesday, February 3rd. Sunday, February 8th, there's going to be it's a concert, Rage Against Racism, 1 p.m. at the Tote in Collingwood.
The Tote?
Mm.
Nice.
And lastly...
Do you know who's organising that?
Let me see.
I've sent you on a side quest. It says,
I'm not sure who organised it, but I know that Mudrat and, well, it's headlined by Mudrat.
Oh my God. Yeah. Well.
Friend of the show.
Oh yes.
And the proceeds are going to be donated to Rise and Crime Scene Australia.
Ah. Oh.
But
that is noteworthy and exciting. Because I missed Mudrat at the People's Blockade up in Newry.
Me too.
And...
You were there.
I had to go to a fundraiser for my cousin who's getting treated for cancer. So that's a side story there. But, yeah, I'm so excited to see Mudrat because, wow, what epic music. Mm. Okay, cool.
And lastly, I'll mention... two more events in February. I know it's jumping ahead into the future, but this is how you organize your year. Saturday, February 21st, Belgrave Survival Day, 2 p.m.
Belgrave Survival Day.
Yeah, it says Belgrave Survival Day, 2
Has that
p.m.
got something to do with fires in that area? Doesn't say. Sorry.
There's a link to it. So it's an annual community event that celebrates the survival strength and culture of First Nations people.
Ah.
It's in the Dandenong Ranges.
Right. Okay. Mm.
And there's a link to all of, like, the Green Left activist calendar has a link to all these events. And lastly, a rally on March 22nd, March in March for forests. And time and location to be announced. All right,
if we have any left.
Exactly.
I mean, tomorrow is going to be a whopper of a hot day. We may, yeah, Get some fires.
Now, as listeners have probably guessed, we haven't been able to get on to Tarneen Onus Williams, unfortunately, but hopefully we can interview at a later stage. So sorry about that, listeners, but we will probably play a song and bring you a little bit more news and discussion shortly. So stick around. We'll just go to a quick break.
Monday, the 26th of January, marks Invasion Day, and 3CR's First Nations broadcast team will be bringing an annual Invasion Day broadcast to the airwaves from 10 a.m.
In 1788, down Sydney Cove, first boat people land, and they say, sorry boys, I gained your loss, we're gonna steal your land.
Our team will be broadcasting speeches from the NAM rally and conversations with people attending the march, as well as connecting with Aboriginal activists from across the continent at the forefront of campaigns for land rights, restoration, restitution, and real treaties, and learning about the way it may be done. And of course, we'll be playing deadly music from our incredible black artists, past and present. So keep it tuned to 3CR, 8:55 a.m., 3CR Digital, 3cr.org.au streaming live on Monday, the 26th of January from 10 a.m.
You're back listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR. And we're coming to the last part of the show, but yeah, we were just going to talk a little bit about Indigenous culture, recognising the kind of links to maybe even socialism. But Zane had a few thoughts on this. I think it's probably important that we talk about this kind of stuff, particularly in the lead up to Invasion Day.
Yeah, look, I think sometimes socialists and lefties will talk at rallies and will kind of make this point that we need to learn from Aboriginal culture and learn from ways, you know, stewardship. But what does that actually look like? We're often a bit vague about that. And many moons ago, I did a unit of Aboriginal studies at the Wallatooka Institute at the University of Newcastle, which is a really excellent Aboriginal studies part of the campus there. And so one of the things we learned about was the totem system. Now, I don't know, like, there's obviously over 500 Aboriginal nations, and there's a lot of diversity within those nations. So I don't know how common the totem system was to absolutely every Aboriginal nation, and nor do I know if the totem system works the same way for different Aboriginal nations. I'm sure it was different from nation to nation. But one of the things we learned about was there would be a conception totem. So when an Aboriginal woman fell pregnant or first became aware that she was pregnant, she may notice certain plants or animals and associate that. And so when the child was born, they would have some connection to these plants or animals. And then again, when the child was born, there would be another totem, their birth totem, which was, again, gave them a relationship to another plant or animal typically. And so what I remember of that class is, for example, if you were a kangaroo, if your birth totem was kangaroo, you were not allowed to eat kangaroo, and then other members of the tribe had to talk to you, and you would, your job for the tribe was to keep an eye on kangaroo populations as you move through country and make sure that you are not overhunting, make sure that you're not hunting, you know, pregnant kangaroos or kangaroos that were carrying, you know, what's a baby kangaroo called? A kangaroo pup?
Joey.
Where's my language? Where's my words? Yeah. So, and I found this really fascinating. Like, I don't know, as a socialist, I've really grappled a lot with the question of Stalinism and how do we stop corruption and how do we stop, you know, how do we have checks and balances against corruption? And so I looked at this totem system and I'm like, that's really clever, because it means that, you know, you're not allowed to eat kangaroo, so you don't have an interest in, you know, taking, you know, saying, oh, yeah, let's go hunt all of them. It's kangaroo day today. And so I found that really clever. And I think you could have a similar thing in modern society where, you know, you might be allowed to have a special vote on, you know, transport policy or education policy, and you're forbidden from working in that sector and gaining from it financially, but at birth you are allocated a particular part of society or economy that you keep an eye on. You're kind of not allowed to work in that area to prevent there being a conflict of interest, but you do get a sort of a special vote on boards or committees that run those things.
There's Harry.
Maybe my totem is a dog.
So I guess, Sane, but it's also a way of managing the environment, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So that seems a very efficient way of managing
the environment. Yeah, I did a brief study on this as an Aboriginal Studies unit, but I'm sure that as part of that totem system, there was probably quite detailed, you know, if you're a kangaroo person, you probably learn from the elders of the tribe and develop quite a detailed understanding of all of the different relevant aspects of kangaroo ecology. So,
yeah. It's interesting. Yeah. I hadn't heard that before. So, it just shows there's a lot that white society can learn from Aboriginal society. I mean, there's that whole issue of management of preventing fires that, you know, people see as a way to perhaps, like Indigenous management of fires, and perhaps this is a way of trying to prevent some of the fires that no doubt are ahead of us.
Yeah, yeah. Cool burning, which, sort of cultivates the diversity of plants in the under canopy and lets little green soft plants grow so there's not a whole bunch of dry stuff that's all going to catch on fire. And then another thing that I noticed more recently, I don't know if either of you have seen this Wurundjeri Eight Seasons calendar.
Nope, haven't seen that one.
Yeah, so I don't know if it was like a poster or a little pamphlet that I saw maybe. And in this part of the world, there was eight seasons. And it talks about the different seasons and how you would sort of, the summer seasons were not like based on a calendar because, you know, people didn't necessarily have calendars back then, but it was more like at this time of year when these certain types of flowers start becoming visible, when the wattles start blooming, you know, that's this, you know, part of, you know, the first part of spring or whatever. Now, one of the things that stood out for me in this Wurundjeri calendar was winter was a time for people to basically shelter from the cold and hang out, fix your spears, fix your clothing, and kind of sit around the fire and not be trying to go out and run around in the icy cold because it's not a good time to be outside. And this, I think, is very relevant to energy policy because if we go to 100% renewable energy, for 9 months of the year, there's abundant electricity. But right in the middle of winter, if you want to make sure that you can run the entire economy 5 days a week, 6 days a week at full output, it's very expensive to put in all of the deep storage and extra batteries and stuff to make sure that in the middle of winter when you have a run of cloudy and cold days that you've got that extra energy. And so then you get, yeah, people be like, oh, and that's why we need to build nuclear power. And I just look at that and I'm like, what? Why? Why do we need to spend twice as much as on our entire energy system just so that we can make sure we're running the economy at full output in the middle of winter? Why can't we have a thing where people work a 2.5 day week in the middle of winter? And that's a time to go and hang out with friends and family and relax. And I don't know, maybe you work a slightly longer work week. In construction, we have this 36-hour week. So you work 9 days and you put aside a little bit of your wage over that 9 days, and then one day a fortnight, you get an RDO. You could have that over the year, and you can have RDOs clustered in the middle of the year. So there's a shorter working week. People can catch up and do political organising in the middle of the year.
Like, storytelling to each other. Yeah, playing music, getting to know their neighbours. These days, people don't have time because they work long hours. Yeah, absolutely.
We can actually have time to spend with the people that we actually care about and have time to do things that we love to do, like, you know, art, music.
Gardening. Yeah, growing your own food. That's right. Without pesticides and chemicals, etc.
Yes. Sounds like a better way to organise society.
So, yeah, I looked at that calendar and I was like, people are working around the seasons, and why don't we do that anymore? Why are we, like, imposing our will as humans on nature and, like, this is how our economy is going to be and this is how it's going to run? Well, why can't our society and our economy be a bit more reflexive and responsive to the world that we live in?
Because we're run by predominantly white men, but there's also white women involved in this, who I think are absolutely neurotic, and whose only self-worth is measured by how much material wealth they can accumulate and how many people, or in Trump's case, how much the world they can dominate. It seems to me that they need that for their mental health, because their mental health is so ratchet, and unfortunately the rest of us suffer because of that.
I guess, like, the Indigenous people's seasons, they actually reveal ancient messaging, because this, like, they've been doing this for what, over 50,000 years, and it kind of sends a message to society today on food sustainability and resilience and even happiness, quality of life. All right, well, we almost lost track of the time. It's actually 8:27, so we're coming to the end of the program, and yeah, we hope listeners enjoyed the show. We'll be back next Friday, and we want to thank our guest Peter Boyle for coming on the show. And
depressing us all.
There was some good stuff in there. And yeah, we are for eco-socialist action, because an ecologically, socially just world is impossible under capitalism. So our goal is an eco-socialist world run by and for people. And yeah, this is, you've been listening to the Green Left show, Green Left Radio on 3CR. For anyone new tuning in, Green Left is a not-for-profit media project publishing news and analysis for Australia and abroad in a style that's accessible for workers and activists. And we're continuing to help build the movements of resistance as well as an anti-capitalist political alternative. And we do this by providing a space for progressive ideas and debates and linking the issues and campaigns and activists. And we let people know how they can join with others to take action. So, we don't receive corporate funding, just like 3CR. Green Left is 100% people powered, and we survive on the contributions and generosity of our supporters. So, if you would like to support the work we do, you can support us for as little as $5 per month. Go to greenleft.org.au/support. But more importantly, get involved in some of the grassroots activist campaigns that we're involved in.
Yeah, come and join Socialist Alliance. It's the best thing you can do in your life.
Yeah. And thank you, Mary and Zane, for presenting the show with me this morning. It's been fun. And Harry for being...
and contributing.
for contributing.
Yeah.
It's words.
Yeah, you know it's grassroots radio when there's a bit of barking in the background.
Yeah. All right, we'll stick around for Left After Breakfast. Ciao.
Bye.
Au revoir.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Morning Breakfast with Green Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.